This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Matthew Sweet's records have a lot of what you want out of pop: catchy melodies, intriguing lyrics, and high-powered guitar playing. Sweet has listened to lots of pop, and in the songs he writes, you can hear many of his influences, like The Beatles, The Byrds, Neil Young, The Beach Boys, and R.E.M. Sweet's third album, Girlfriend, released in 1991, was his breakthrough record. On his new CD, Blue Sky on Mars, Sweet plays most of the instruments himself: guitar, bass, and synthesizers. And of course, he sings. Before we meet him, let's hear a track from his new CD. This is his song, Over It.
You're over it. You're not angry anymore because you're over it. No big deal unless you make it one. You don't even have to fake it now. You're over it. You're over it. And in a way, you should never have to fear. You can get you safe. If you're looking all around you and there's nothing that's profound, you know.
That's Matthew Sweet from his new album, Blue Sky on Mars. When did you know that music was it for you?
I think I knew pretty early on in my teens, probably when I was in junior high. I used to say, I know I'll do something in music. I certainly didn't think I'd be doing what I do now and be a solo artist or anything. I guess I more thought, you know, I'll play bass in a band, or, you know, maybe I'll be a studio bass player or something like that.
Did you play in bands in high school?
I did, yeah. I played with, you know, various kids around junior high. We played at an assembly, I remember, in seventh grade, my first year of junior high. I played in a band that played Carry On My Wayward Son by Kansas, and I can't remember what the other song we played was. We played two songs at an assembly at school. And so, yeah, I played in various bands. When I was in high school, I was like the kid member of a band of a bunch of guys who were in college. They were called the Specs, and we were like kind of a new wave cover band, although we played some kind of 60s songs like the Yardbirds, or my big number in the band where I sang was My Generation by The Who. And they were originally like a prog rock group called Spectrum, and then they went new wave and were called the Specs. At this time, I was probably 13, 14 years old, and we would play at proms and high school dances and things.
So when you sang My Generation, was that supposed to be ironic since you weren't of the generation?
Well,
of
I don't know if we thought that much about it. That just happened to be my number that I got to sing.
I was wondering,
although I guess it was ironic.
How much time when you were a teenager did you spend in your bedroom just recording demos of your own songs and overdubbing? And
I spent a lot of time doing that. I guess it was probably, I worked in a music store in Lincoln called Dietz Music after school and on weekends. And I guess it was when I was working there that I first got a hold of the new technology of the four-track cassette recorder, which really, I think, made multi-track recording much more available to people in general than it had been before. Cost-wise, it was much less expensive than you probably were able to do multi-tracking before then. And had I not had a multi-track to work on, I don't know if I'd be doing what I do today, because I was very, very shy about singing. I was shy about writing songs. And if I hadn't been able to hide out, you know, in my bedroom with no one hearing me and figure it out myself, you know, singing along with my own instrumentation, I don't know if I'd have ever stuck my neck out to do it. So I definitely regard myself as coming from what I would call the Porta Studio generation. And I imagine you'll probably see more and more people these days who could probably point to that era as being important for them.
No, you mentioned performing for high school auditorium gigs.
Right, yeah.
You didn't have to do things like do Arbor Day songs on Arbor Day or anything like that. Did you? I mean, this is my memories of school. Some horrible songs.
Well, not so much. I do have some great memories of songs like my grade school graduation, we sang The Way We Were. Which I thought was good. When I think about it now, I think that's pretty
funny.
Oh, what
kind of absurd nostalgia.
But that was the whole class sang it, you know.
What'd y'all do on the high notes?
Oh, we could all sing pretty high, I think, at that age.
Too funny. Now, your breakthrough record, Girlfriend, was actually your third record. You had earlier records with Columbia and with A&M, both major record labels. Why do you think Girlfriend took off and that the first two albums didn't? Do you think it was something in your music, something in the marketing, something in the time?
I just think that I had come of age sort of as an artist. It was the first record I made, I think, that was totally me. It really kind of felt right to me. It was the first record I had any expectations about, where I finished making it and I said, you know, there's something good about this. Somebody will like it, which I think before then, I don't think I ever expected anybody else to like what I was doing necessarily. And it was still a difficult record to get released, but it didn't really sound like other records at the time. It was very dry recording, which was not yet in vogue then.
Dry as opposed to a lot of reverb?
There was no reverb on that record. And now that's a really common thing on the radio, but at the time, that was kind of an old-fashioned way to make a record. It was more of a 70s way to record or something.
Well, interesting. Tell us the story of how Girlfriend was signed.
There was a guy named Scott Byron who was working for a fledgling BMG label called Zoo Entertainment, and he really liked the record and sort of convinced his label to sign it, and we kind of got into legal affairs and made the deal, and then they decided, well, we've signed too many things, we're not going to sign it. So it was again in limbo, and finally, I guess about 9 months after the record was mastered and finished, Zoo Entertainment came back on. One day I got a phone call. They were going to sign the record. And as the story was told to me, Lou Malia, the president of the label, was walking through the hallway and heard the album being played by Bud Scapa, who was head of artist development. Bud was a writer for Rolling Stone in the 70s, and he had gone and worked out that morning and listened to the record again and thought, you know, I'm going to write a memo and try and drum up some more interest. And while he was playing it, getting ready, getting his computer started and everything to write the memo, Lou stuck his head in and said, "What is that, Bud?" And Bud said, "Well, it's the Matthew Sweet record, Lou." And he said, "Yeah, I like that. You know, what's our status on that?" And Bud said, you passed on it, Lou." And he said, "Oh, you think we should sign that?" And he said, "Yeah." And he said, "Okay, I'm going to go down and tell legal affairs." So I guess that's how my life turned around, really. It was that random. And had that not happened that day, I don't know what the course would have been with the record.
Well, let's hear a song from your CD, Girlfriend, the CD that really put you on the map. And the song I'd like to play is Divine Intervention. I think it's really catchy, and when we're done hearing it, I'd like to talk with you about the lyric. This is Matthew Sweet.
I cannot understand my God. I don't know why it gets to me. Joy. And then we finally disagree. And all depending on his divine intervention.
It's Matthew Sweet from his earlier CD, Girlfriend. Matthew, why did you want to write a song in which the question, is there a God, prominently figures?
Well, I think at the time I wrote the song, I was in my early 20s. I was like really starting to think more about how I felt about God, whether I thought there was one. It wasn't even something where I decided to do it. I don't think I sat down and said, I'm going to write a song about my feelings about God. I just started having songs now and then where God, you know, popped up in them. And I think it's not the only one on Girlfriend. In fact, I remember early on hearing some comments. Somebody said it was too religious for them. And I remember that really stuck with me because that was when I realized, wow, I'm really talking about this like in a few songs.
So were you wrestling with that a lot?
I think that I was, you know. I think that in a way, a lot of my God references, especially on that record, were more meant as kind of swipes at God a little bit, you know. It was funny because people who are really religious tended to look at it in a positive light, like it was this, you know, oh yes, we all have to have our faith and, you know, pray for divine intervention. Whereas I meant it a little more sarcastically, I think.
Anyone from Christian pop approach you? And
well, there's always the confusion because of Michael Sweet from the Christian rock band Striper went solo after Striper. So every now and then there is a little bit of confusion between the two of us.
My guest is Matthew Sweet. He has a new CD called Blue Sky on Mars. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with songwriter, singer, and musician Matthew Sweet. Let me get in another song from your new CD. And the CD is called Blue Sky on Mars. And I want to play Behind the Smile, a song that I think of as having the title Good Friend. tell me about this song before we hear it.
Behind the Smile. Well, I didn't mean for it to, but right after I wrote it, I realized it had an obvious reference to Girlfriend, which, by the way, the song Girlfriend was originally called Good Friend. And Behind the Smile starts with, you know, I haven't been a good friend. And in a way, it echoes a feeling I have a lot of the time, I think, since my career has somewhat taken over my life. I feel more and more unable to kind of keep up with all my friends and people I know and kind of be a good friend to other people. So it's a little bit my confession of that feeling. There's a line in Behind the Smile that really means a lot to me in the kind of bridge section where it says, you know, I'm fighting to be real. And it's just gives me a little chill when I hear that line. And I think it just is, it just means, you know, I'm trying not to let everything else, you know, take me away from who I was, you know, originally. So Behind the Smile is one of the most important songs to me on the new record.
Well, let's hear it. And this is from Matthew Sweet's new CD, Blue Sky on Mars. That's Matthew Sweet. Matthew, before we heard that, you were saying that the line about fighting to be real was an important line to you. What are you trying to protect yourself from? I mean, I'm wondering if you've seen a lot of people who've been in the middle of that power spot, you know, the microphone on stage, and have been transformed in not very good ways by it.
I don't know if it comes from me seeing that in other people so much. Maybe more from my own experience and my own fears about it. It's a strange life where you talk about yourself all the time, and it's like your name projected to be this person out in the world. And I've always really tried to get a lot of my real self into my records and into the artwork. I always been putting my weird hobbies, you know, on the covers of my records and things. Sometimes it's just gets to feel sort of overwhelming, like too much meanness, you know, and it kind of drives me crazy. And maybe I have fear of like, what do I really feel? Who am I really? You know, I'll just get kind of worn out emotionally doing what I do, and sort of sticking so much of my personal self kind of out into the world.
What do you do right before and right after you get on stage?
Before we go on stage, I'll usually play CDs of bands I like. I'll jump up and down a lot and kind of get warmed up, sing along a lot, try and warm up my voice. And when I come off stage, I usually I'll go back on the bus, change clothes. I sweat a whole lot, so I'm always completely wet after I play. So I have to get changed. And then I'll go up to the front of the bus and we'll sign autographs for whoever's waiting. That's become a real routine over the last couple of years, especially. There's almost always a group of people kind of waiting outside. And until I've kind of gotten through signing stuff and all of that, I can't really relax. So that's the next thing I do.
You keep mentioning the bus. You don't fly. You don't like to fly anyway.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, touring here in the States, we probably wouldn't be flying that much anyway. But yeah, I have terrible fear of flying, and I did do it a whole lot for many years. It got to the point where I was having to do a lot of things where I flew every day, a lot of international flights. And I guess it reached its kind of hardest point for me during the time of Altered Beast, which was the last time I toured internationally. And I really had some big problems with it during that time. I guess I was feeling a lot of pressure about the record in general. I was having to do a lot of explaining about it. Then combined with all the flying I was doing, I just started to kind of have mini nervous breakdowns. And a couple of times I had to sort of call it quits and go home for a few days. And during that time, I saw someone about it. I got hypnotized. You know, I tried all kinds of things. But what ended up happening is my manager really came to me at the end of the Altered Beast campaign. He said, okay, for the next record, how about you don't do any flying at all, and we'll just tour in the States and in Canada. And I said, great, sounds wonderful to me. I can't believe you think we could get away with it. And but that's what we did for 100% Fun. I didn't fly at all, and I haven't flown in, gosh, I guess 3.5 years now. And that record did very well for me. I was really focused for it. It went gold within about 9 months. I guess Girlfriend finally went gold the same year. So it was a really good year for me. Had my first Canadian gold record. I'm not saying because I didn't fly, but it was a good year for me. I have found that this year there's much, much more pressure internationally to go over and tour. For some reason, people are really liking the new record out in all the territories. And so I'm finally going to go to Europe in August. I'm planning on going across on the QE2. My wife's going to travel over there with me. And we're going to tour as extensively as we can over there while I'm there.
What shape did your mini nervous breakdowns take?
I would describe it as just a very black cloud kind of feeling. I would just get a very bad feeling. It was kind of the first indication I would have. Just a bad funk kind of mood. Just very dark. I didn't feel like talking to anybody. I would get really nauseous, start throwing up a lot. I'd just throw up just kind of spontaneously, not really in any connection with anything. Crying just for no reason. I would a lot. It manifested itself as I couldn't sleep. I would be like up all night, just kind of having like waking nightmares. You know, it was pretty nasty. Really, I was just not kind of coming apart emotionally.
You must have been pretty scared by that.
I was really scared by it. I thought that I might go crazy. You know, I occasionally will get a little bit that feeling nowadays, and it's very scary. You know, it makes me think, am I going to go crazy someday? It's like the main thing I would think. And I would try and say to myself, you know I've felt better than this. I know I can get back to that feeling somehow when I felt better, you know. It's funny because talking about it now, I remember a time when I had a period where I went through that was like that when I was about 19 years old, almost like a midlife crisis, but way too young, you know? I went through a period a little bit like that where I was kind of shell-shocked. I couldn't sleep. Any noises and things would really freak me out, you know? But generally, I'm a pretty normal person, you know? I don't come apart much. I'm pretty strong. So the flying thing really was the lethal element added to the other stresses of my life after the success of Girlfriend that really put me over the edge was my fear of flying.
Matthew Sweet will be back with us a little later. His new CD is called Blue Sky on Mars. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with songwriter, singer, and musician Matthew Sweet. His new CD is called Blue Sky on Mars. Let's talk about songwriting.
Okay.
When you're writing a song, so many of your songs have, in the real kind of spirit of pop, a really solid hook that they're built around. Does the hook come to you first? Whether the hook is the catchy phrase or the catchy, you know, lyrical phrase or musical phrase?
Well, I would say music comes the easiest to me.
Before the lyric.
Before lyrics, usually, although not always. Sometimes I'll have a lyrical idea first, or I'll write words and music kind of simultaneously. But more often than not, I have more of the music first, and maybe some words, you know. And it's not something I think about a lot, you know. I almost think of it like there's this universe kind of in my head, and it's all full of all these melodies going on all the time. And when I kind of get in the mode where I turn that on, I could just come up with a different melody like all the time, and it's really kind of, it's almost routine to me to do that. I think if there's the biggest misconception people have about me is how carefully constructed my songs are and stuff, because they're very freeform to me, how they're written. I guess I have a real sense after making demos for so many years of kind of how to structure things. You know, it's something I don't think about a whole lot. I remember when I was early on in my career, I did some writing with Jules Shear, just a great songwriter and a great friend of mine. And Jules said to me, Matthew, how come you don't ever work on your songs? Like, do you ever think about like taking one that like has something good in it and like, you know, working on it and making it better? And the reason he said that to me is because I would tend to, there would be songs every now and then that somebody would like, you know, a part of it, but, you know, not so much the rest of it. And I tend to write so many songs, I would never take a song and fix it. I'd just write more songs until one came along that seemed more whole. And so it's never been my problem writing lots of material. The work really comes later on when you have to talk about it and explain it and everything.
So it sounds like there's a little faucet someplace that you turn on and the melody comes out.
It's totally like a faucet, and it usually has a lot to do with how I'm feeling emotionally when I will write. If I'm really down and feeling melancholy or depressed about my life, I'll always write songs in that mood. If I'm really excited and hyped up about something in my life, I'll write songs in that mood as well. So I've come to think of it as being like whenever I have excess emotion, that's when I'll write songs. And I guess it just happens often enough that I will rarely find myself in a situation where, oh no, I've got to write some songs, you know, I've got to make a record. More often than not, I have far more songs than I could ever record.
Did you ever get flack from your friends for liking pop and for writing pop as opposed to, say, you know, heavy metal or really heavy hardcore of one sort or another? Did people think, oh, this is too light? This is.
I think I don't think I ever so much got flack from my friends as much as just the media in general. From especially early on in my career, I got a lot of the, you know, sappy love songs. Mm-hmm. You know, happy people tend to, when they hear melodies, they think it's all about happy go lucky. You know, I find people don't often take the time to actually listen to what the words are saying. And I think on my records, you often find some of the sunnier melodies undercut by some kind of subversive lyric. But over the years, I see that less. I think I just found over time that's what I really care about are good melodies, and I think that's a thing that I do as far as doing really melodic music that not everybody does. And so I feel more and more of a responsibility to like go for that pop angle.
Matthew Sweet, a real pleasure to talk with you.
Oh, same here. Thanks.
Matthew Sweet's new CD is called Life on Mars.